This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Instant Genius, a bite-sized masterclass in podcast form. Each week, you'll hear world-leading experts talking about the most fascinating ideas in science and technology today. I'm Jason Goodyear, commissioning editor at BBC Science Focus. These days, as many as 60% of us are turning to the internet or social media to get health advice. It's a staggering number, especially when you consider the fact that literally anyone, regardless of their background or qualifications, can set up an account and start giving out lifestyle or dietary tips that can have a huge effect on our well-being. In this episode, I speak to Dr. Itz, an NHS doctor with a background in nutritional research. He's made it his mission to fight the misinformation doled out on social media and provide scientifically accurate health advice. In doing so, he's racked up almost 2 million followers on TikTok and almost 300,000 on Instagram. He tells us about some of the most common and potentially dangerous nutrition myths that abound on social media that he busts in his book, Saturated Fats. So first off, welcome to the show. And can you tell us a bit about yourself? You know, what's your background and what made you start doing TikTok videos?
Yeah, of course. No, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I like this question a lot because, you know, people are often a bit surprised as to kind of the journey that I've been on. Basically, I went to medical school at the University of East Anglia, and they have a very, you know, kind of integrated, kind of holistic style of doing medical school. They're not like a traditional style where you have preclinical, just lectures, just, you know, pharmacology, just physiology. We kind of see everything from the first week of the first year. And what that enabled me to do was kind of appreciate the role that kind of diet, lifestyle, preventative medicine has on long-term health outcomes. And as I was going through medical school, I had the great opportunity to take a break out of medical school and pursue another master's degree in nutritional research, which was funded by the university itself as well. And then I came back to finish my medical school studies. And then after I became a doctor, I became board certified in lifestyle medicine by a great organization called the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. So they're a relatively new branch of lifestyle medicine in the UK. And they're following the likes of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. So we're really seeing every year lots of physicians, lots of registered nutritionists, lots of dietitians, pharmacists that are pursuing this preventative lifestyle medicine space. And it's really starting to have a big uptick. And what happened with the kind of videos was it was during the 2021 lockdown around January time. And I remember my doctor colleagues, they said to me, because I used to be a personal trainer and nutrition advisor, they said to me, because now you can't do any of those activities anymore because of these, you know, sporadic lockdowns and gyms not being open and, you know, no one being able to come to your house and things like that, why don't you give the advice you were giving to people in person? Why don't you just put it online instead? And I said, yeah, maybe, you know, why, you know, how would I do it? And they said, well, the new biggest thing now is TikTok, right? And I said, oh, come on, surely that's not just full of, you know, 13-year-old girls dancing in front of the camera, right? And they said, no, like the education space is actually really big. So I was like, okay, fine. So I downloaded the app, and literally the algorithm's so smart, it's just crazy how social media does it. But within kind of 10, 15 minutes of me scrolling, I entered the wellness space, right? And what I saw was just horrendous. I saw viral videos of, you know, ladies holding a cucumber lemon blend of green, and then she captioned it, how I lost 20 pounds in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And I was just like, what? And there was tens of thousands of comments being like, oh, I'm starting this tomorrow. Oh, thank you so much. Amazing. And I was scrolling like, people can't be serious, right? That was kind of the light bulb moment for me where I knew I had to do something. I was like, this is ridiculous. I can't just be scrolling on this app, looking at all the stuff that people are buying into, all of the potentially harmful, you know, financially damaging, you know, like fads and trends out there. So I dipped my toes in the water and I just started off with funny kind of gym fitness related videos. And then very quickly, people started tagging me in, you know, other people's videos asking me to either validate or invalidate it. So I was like, oh, interesting. So then I started responding to other creators' videos. And that's when there was a massive uptick. I was gaining 100,000 followers a month from responding to people. And the clear desire or the need to have online information vetted was just apparent. And now I've never looked back.
So that brings us to your book then, Saturated Facts. So in the book, you look at some of these common diet and nutrition myths. So the first question is, why do you think these myths are so pervasive and so persuasive?
Yeah, good question. I think a lot of it has to do with, first of all, the complexity of health and nutrition science. It's very, very complex. You know, the parallel or the comparison I like to make typically when explaining this is, if you take a pharmaceutical research study where you're comparing the effects of a new drug, or, you know, maybe you're comparing a new one to an old one, all you have to do is get two groups of people who are very similar in terms of demographic health-related outcomes, and you give one group the drug and you give one group a comparison or a placebo, right? And then you monitor that over time, okay? That's a very simple study design, and it's a very easy way for researchers to assess whether that drug is having a benefit or not, okay? Now, in nutrition and lifestyle and diet, it's a lot more complicated than that, because if you're wanting to ascertain the effects of a specific nutrient or food, you need to realize people don't eat foods in isolation. They don't eat nutrients by itself. This is all part of the food matrix. So when you've got someone that eats three times a day and you're following thousands of people over time, how do you know if the vitamin B12 or the vitamin D or the calcium or the magnesium is having the positive effect? Or is it the whole host of other factors involved in someone's diet and lifestyle that could be at play? So that's number one. I think nutrition and health research is very, very complicated and people get confused. And when the layperson reads, to be honest, even lots of professionals, when anyone reads headlines or, you know, the abstract of a research study, it's very hard to understand what's going on. So naturally, there's going to be a lot of contradictory, conflicting information. Number two, nutrition and diet and lifestyle is very emotive. It's very personal for people. People have a real affinity to want to reinforce or reaffirm their previously held beliefs. So confirmation bias is a huge thing in health research. You know, you can show creators 1,000 different forms of evidence from different populations, and they'll still believe that, you know, seed oils are toxic, or, you know, natural is better, or an all meat diet is superior to a vegan diet, or whatever, right? And bear in mind that 60% of UK adults now, over 60%, go to online or internet sources for their health information. So that's a really alarming statistic, because us as professionals, we need to meet where the patient, where the consumer is looking. So no one's looking at, you know, GP handout booklets or leaflets, or no one's looking at poster presentations. No one's looking at medical journals anymore. They're getting their health information from social media. So if people like myself don't meet them where the person is looking, we can't hope to have an impact on this space.
So let's have a look at some of these sort of common trends that you talk about in the book in a bit more detail then. So first one, I think anyone that's looked into this kind of thing will have heard of is the keto diet. It's been really popular over recent years and is kind of lauded as a sort of one-stop shop, not only for weight loss, but overall better health.
Yeah.
So what exactly is it and what do its proponents claim?
Yeah, good. So the ketogenic diet is a diet that's very high in fat, moderate protein, and extremely low in carbohydrates. There are some iterations that is even below, 10 to 20 grams of carbohydrates a day, which is literally nothing. So, it was actually originally invented or utilized as a dietary intervention for pharmacoresistant epilepsy in kids. So bear in mind that actually this diet didn't come about as a weight loss diet. It's only been implemented as such in recent history. Its proponents often state things like, you'll get superior weight loss benefits, you'll see a massive drop in weight, but people confuse that for being fat when actually it's just water weight. Because when you cut out all carbohydrates, once you've depleted your glycogen stores in your muscle and your liver, for every gram of glycogen, we hold about 3 to 4 grams of water. So naturally, when you go on the keto diet, in the first week, you're going to drop, for the average person in the UK, you might drop, 5, 7, 8, 9 pounds. So that's a few kilograms of weight. But bear in mind, it's not actually fat. Other people claim that not only is it superior for weight loss, it's a really good way to reverse insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes, a very good way to reverse or improve fatty liver disease, and even improve some aspects of mental health and cognitive decline. Now, a lot of these benefits can be solely attributable to the actual any kind of weight that you lose in the short term. So bear in mind that just because you're able to improve some outcomes in terms of type 2 diabetes, in terms of fatty liver disease, or even waist circumference or markers of metabolic syndrome, that doesn't actually mean the ketogenic diet is the best diet. It just means that you've managed to lose a bit of weight and now some of these health outcomes are improving. What's really interesting is when you compare diets that are balanced up to 60% of total calories from carbohydrates to ketogenic style diets where you've almost got zero carbohydrates, as long as the calories are matched and the total number of calories you're eating are the same, there is actually minimal differences in type 2 diabetes improvement, in overall weight loss outcomes, in overall, fatty liver improvement outcomes. Bear in mind that typically a ketogenic diet will have a lot more saturated fat intake. And when you look at isocaloric, meaning same calorie studies, people that are already a healthy weight and they're not doing the diet because of a weight loss problem, you actually see worsening markers in liver enzymes and type 2 diabetes markers when you look at people who are already at the same weight. So they're not actually losing weight. So this is the kind of nuance that people often miss. And they think that just because they're having short-term success on the ketogenic diet, it's very, very difficult to sustain or adhere to that style of eating for the rest of your life. What I like to say is don't do a dietary intervention as a short-term fix for anything, because your health is dependent on long-term habits, sustainable habits that you can maintain for decades.
So another commonly talked about method to drop a few pounds and improve your health, so the claims go, is intermittent fasting. So there's currently a lot of different approaches to this, but what's the basic idea?
Yeah, so the basic idea is there are lots of iterations of intermittent fasting. You have typical ones include, 16-8 fasting, which is you fast for 16 hours of the day and you have an 8-hour eating window. There are also 24, so 20 hours of fasting, 4 hours of eating. Then you've got other fancy iterations such as the alternate day fasting where you fast on for one day and eat for the next day. Basically, all of these styles of diet, they kind of stem back to people advocating for, we have to eat like our ancestors, like our hunter-gatherer ancestors, right? Food wasn't available at all times. And yes, that is true, of course. We live in a society now where within 10 minutes after this podcast, I'm going to press a button on my phone and I'm going to have a hot meal at my door in 10 minutes. Right? Obviously, we've never been able to do that in the history of mankind. So what they're saying is, don't be afraid to go long periods of time without eating to enable our gut to kind of, you know, rest and digest per se, you know, to avoid the overconsumption of food, you know, and lots of other reasons, you know, maybe aligns with our natural bodily systems. What I will say is the majority of intermittent fasting protocols, they improve health outcomes simply because you are restricting the time in which you're eating. Therefore, you're restricting how many calories you're eating, right? So that's where the majority of its benefits lie. Now, whether that's for, you know, chronic metabolic disease, you know, PCOS, type 2 diabetes, fatty liver, obesity, even aspects of mental health improvements as well. Now, where it does get a bit more complicated is when you're choosing to have your eating window. So let's say your waking hours are from 8 to 8, right? You wake up at 8 a.m., you go to sleep at 8 p.m. Okay, fine. If you're choosing to have your eating window towards the later part of that day, so let's say from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. or 12 to 8 p.m., then you might not see any additional benefits. The benefits that you'll see will largely come from just because you're restricting your eating window. Where there might be additional benefits beyond just simply restricting your calories is when you consume your eating window in the earlier part of the day. Now, I talk about this in my book. There's a whole chapter called Chrononutrition, where I talk about the science of meal timing. Now, stacking evidence from the last 15, 20 years with lots of control studies are showing that when you consume your food in the earlier part of the day where you have the majority of your calories, that's better for glucose regulation, so how well we can manage our blood glucose levels, for fatty acid oxidation, so that's how, you know, efficiently we can break down fats, just for general energy and lethargy outcomes as well. So, and also the big one, appetite regulation. There was a really well, tightly controlled study done in 2022 by Ruddock and colleagues, where they gave participants the exact same food, the exact same meals they were provided by the researchers. I think it was 40 to 45% of their calories at breakfast versus the group that had 40 to 45% at dinner. The group that had the front loading, so the big breakfast, they had significantly improved appetite and satiety levels or hunger levels across the rest of the day. So that implies that if you have a large breakfast as a routine, which better aligns with our circadian rhythm, you'll be much more effective at controlling our total calories, not giving in to, you know, cravings late at night and not feeling the need to snack and overindulge. So there are lots of additional benefits that come from shifting our calories earlier in the day. Now, whether you choose to intermittent fast in that way, then you might see additional benefits. But if you're doing the typical, you know, 12 to 8 p.m. fast, then you might just get benefits from the fact that you're restricting your calories.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
So another dietary choice that's hugely gained popularity over the last few years is veganism, or its offshoot, plant-based eating. Obviously, there are lots of reasons why people might want to adopt this style of eating, you know, for environmental reasons or considerations about animal welfare. But do these types of diet actually provide any health benefits?
Yeah, good question. So what I like to say about most dietary patterns is it can be done extremely well or extremely poorly. You know, just because someone's vegan doesn't mean that they'll be having a healthy dietary pattern, yeah? And, you know, the only exception to that, I'd probably say, is the carnivore-style diet. There is no iteration of an animal-only diet that will be healthy in anyone's book, right? So that's the only style of diet where you can't have a good and a bad style of eating. But the vegan diet is a very kind of interesting one, because a lot of people who adopt it, they automatically assume that they'll just improve their health just by going vegan. But you have to remember that we live in an obesogenic environment now, where the majority of our eating pattern comes from ultra-processed, heavily refined foods with lots of added sugars, lots of added oils, added fats, which add unnecessary amount of calories. You know, food manufacturers are very smart now. They know what combination of nutrients to include in a product to get you to really indulge and be find it very, very tasty, right? So if you look at any kind of mainstream desserts or patisseries or donuts or cakes, they will have a combination of sugars, fats, and a bit of salt. So when you provide that combination of ingredients, the body is like, whoa, this is a really tasty food. I'm not just going to have one slice, I'm going to have several. And they're loaded with calories. So that's where the issue arises, is just because you're plant-based, we really still need to be focusing on minimally processed foods. So foods that typically resemble, you know, the food that appeared in nature. Right. I'm not saying you have to literally go and pick your apples from the tree. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the closer the food resembles to its original form, typically the more satiating, the more filling, the less you'll be able to eat, because food naturally comes, or a lot of plant foods naturally come with fiber. And the big problem with ultra processed foods is you're stripping the fiber from that food and you're condensing it into a tight package like a bar or a packet or a chocolate or whatever, and that becomes really, really easy to overeat. So just bear in mind that plant-based eating can obviously be very, very healthy for you, and this is something I elaborate on in the book. But remember, you have to still be mindful about what you're choosing to eat day in, day out, because the rise of, you know, junk vegan food these days is huge. You know, I love having junk vegan food. Like, I can't get halal meat everywhere I go, so I love going to an exclusively vegan restaurant and having, you know, it's called like chicken burgers, right? It's like fake chicken burgers and stuff, right? So just bear in mind that just because something's vegan doesn't make it healthy. You still have to be mindful. But of course, you know, lots of people are, and rightly so, they are taking up a plant-based diet because of the environmental concerns, the ethical concerns, and that's perfectly fine. Don't make claims that something is healthy just because you're plant-based. You have to still be mindful.
So you mentioned earlier there that this idea of the carnivore diet. So I've seen some influencers claiming that their diet consists almost solely of animal protein. That's obviously not a good idea, you said.
Yeah. I mean, this is probably the most dangerous dietary trend of the last couple of decades at least. And the reason why it's dangerous is not because of the effects people will see in the short term. It's because we know unequivocally that when you exceed saturated fat intake beyond 10% of total energy, so for most people, that would be, you know, more than 25, 30 grams a day, right? That's actually not that much. If you get a really fatty cut of meat, you can easily hit 15, 20 grams of saturated fat there, like very, very easily, right? The issue is that when you exceed 10% of total energy from such saturated fat, all of the controlled research, which was done by actually my previous research methods lecturer in the University of East Anglia called Lee Hooper, she has done multiple meta-analyses of multiple controlled trials, which show that the rates of cardiovascular events and outcomes such as heart attacks, strokes, you know, cardiovascular disease, vessel disease, you know, plaque formation, a lot of these outcomes, the actual rates of incidence are pretty low when you hit 7%, 8%, 9%. Then when you hit 10%, there's a massive rise across all of these outcomes. So we know that there's a threshold the body likes, and we know that when you exceed that threshold over decades, you'll likely cause yourself lots of problems. The reason why the carnivore diet is dangerous is because people are confusing short-term feeling good with long-term health outcomes, right? So because the carnivore diet strips you of all plant-based foods, for example, people that have very severe chronic gut issues like celiac disease, you know, IBS, inflammatory bowel disease, you know, lots of intolerances to different fibers or fruits, then when you go to a carnivore diet, you're obviously going to feel like it's doing something good because you're no longer consuming plant-based fibers. So when you don't consume those fibers, you allow your gut to rest and, you know, you might not have any bloating or flatulence or diarrhea or constipation. Fine, fair enough. But this is called an elimination diet. This is not a diet that you're supposed to be doing over the long term, right? These are supposed to be medically supervised, controlled diets where you're supposed to reintroduce these plant foods slowly over time, where your gut can actually slowly adapt to it and build the microbiome necessary to digest it properly. So the problem is people are confusing, oh, my gut feels so much better now. I'm not lightheaded. I don't have bloating. I don't have diarrhea. Therefore, my health must be improving. No, because we don't see cardiovascular or cancer outcomes, not for several decades. So there was a really interesting anecdote that I cited in my book, actually, because we know that the carnivore diet trend love anecdotes. So I decided to give them a taste of their own medicine, right? There was a gentleman called Michael Riley who documented his entire story on Twitter. And he was a very lean, you know, athletic, six-pack washboard abs kind of guy. And he was on the carnivore diet for, I think, over 6 years. And what they found, that even though he felt fantastic, you know, he was living his life, when he got checked up medically, they found that his coronary arteries were blocked by 95%, right? And this was the left anterior descending artery, which we call in medicine the widowmaker, right? And we call it the widowmaker because when that gets blocked, it kills because it supplies the majority of the heart, right? So if he never got life-saving surgery, you know, that time he got checked, there's a very, very strong chance he would have basically just immediately passed away from a massive, you know, MI or myocardial infarction or heart attack, as we call it in medicine. So we're now starting to see more and more, you know, personal stories of harm being done by people that have been on the carnivore diet for many, many years. But unfortunately, we're not going to see the true damage for another decade. So I really, really just advise, strongly encourage people to not make it a long-term way of life. If you want to eliminate plant foods completely, then do it where it's medically supervised for a short period of time, where the aim is to slowly reintroduce plant foods back into your diet.
So you kind of touched on this right at the start, but another prevalent trend is so-called detox diets. So what's everybody getting wrong about those?
Yeah, so, you know, just today, actually, I saw a video that I was tagged in. I get tagged in probably 200 plus videos a day. And the idea that we can enhance our detox pathways to become a superhuman and live to the age of 120. Like, you see this kind of narrative a lot, and it's just very stupid because, you know, a lot of our organs, our lungs, our skin, our liver, right, our gut, our kidneys, you know, they all play an essential part in detoxification, right? And this is why, for example, when someone goes out on a heavy Friday night, you know, drinking alcohol, we don't just immediately pass away from chronic toxicity, right? We don't pass away because our body is doing what it's designed to do, which is filtering out actual harmful toxins. And that's why our kidneys are so powerful and they filter so much, you know, plasma and blood every single day. So the idea that you can do specific dietary or lifestyle things to somehow turn on certain detox pathways is just absurd because detoxification is happening every single minute of the day. Obviously, we can support our organs that do detoxification. Of course, you know, like reducing our intake of saturated fat, increasing our intake of polyunsaturated fat to enhance liver function. We can increase our fiber intake so we can reduce the amount of fats that are getting blocked in our system. If you have any kind of skin triggers, you know, getting some sunlight or vitamin D onto our skin every day can obviously improve our state of, you know, skin function and skin health. Obviously, just generally living a positive and healthful lifestyle will, of course, improve our body's ability to detoxify any kind of poison or toxin, right? But to market the idea that there are certain specific protocols that you can employ or buy or supplements you can take to, you know, turn on some kind of superpower detoxifier, it's just really, really gimmicky and really kind of sad that a lot of people are buying into it. And I feel for people's bank accounts.
So kind of by way of summing up what we've just talked about in the last half an hour or so, I mean, what key piece of advice would you give to anybody who's listening to take away from this and actually implement in their daily lives?
Yeah, I would say the best thing you can do, especially if you're a social media user or scroller, I would say is to develop what I like to call your BS radar, right? So develop your ability to spot misinformation, disinformation, and the ways in which you can do that include things like people that blame a single food or nutrient for the rise in chronic disease is just talking waffle, because chronic disease doesn't happen from one single thing. It happens due to a culmination of biological, psychological, and socio-environmental factors, right? So any scientist knows that. And so any credible scientist will not blame the rise in disease on a single thing. So if you hear that, immediately scroll on, block, unfollow, whatever. The second thing I'll say is watch out for absolutist statements. So people making claims that are extremely confident and extremely all-encompassing. So for example, they'll say things like, these are the five worst foods for your health, right? Who are you talking to? You're talking to lots of different people with different, you know, medical conditions, with different demographics who might be intolerant. Or, for example, if you take myself and you take someone that's got a flare-up of inflammatory bowel disease, an apple for me is obviously not going to be harmful, but an apple for them can cause major gut issues, you know, pain, rises in inflammation, you know, maybe constipation or diarrhea, you know, excessive ill health. And that's because any two people are not the same. So whilst we do have general dietary principles that everyone should employ, the specifics of, you know, these are the five worst foods for you, they don't apply like that. So people that lack balance and nuance in their arguments, you don't want to listen to what they have to say. And there are other things that you can look out for, you know, buzzwords like inflammatory without any real meaning. You know, they're not actually explaining what is actually increasing in inflammation. They're just throwing out a buzzword, you know, detox, gut health. Yeah, okay, gut health, not so much, but still people do use gut health in a very buzzword kind of clickbaity way. There are these, you know, techniques that you can look for when scrolling your social media feeds or looking to headlines in magazines and newspapers to really enlighten you as to what is probably credible and what's not credible. Right. So if you develop your radar like this, you'll be far better protected from, you know, coming across or actually believing misinformation or disinformation. So I go through a lot of these claims and fads in my social media pages. And also I debunk the majority of them in immense detail in my book, of course, as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Instant Genius, brought to you from the team behind BBC Science Focus. That was NHS doctor and social media star, Dr. Ids. To read more about the topics we've just discussed, check out his book, Saturated Facts, or follow him on TikTok or Instagram as @Dr_Ids. If you liked what you just heard, please consider subscribing to Instant Genius on your preferred podcast platform. The current issue of BBC Science Focus magazine is out now. Pick up a copy wherever you buy your favourite magazines, or download a copy on your app store of choice. You can also find us online at sciencefocus.com.